Mr. Archer, it is kind of fun because there's so many options. I have the brother, Dave, brother-in-law, Mr. Archer. So many choices, so little time. Well, a couple weeks back, I gave a message talking about the first commandment, and we kind of set the groundwork for that in that message. We're going to be looking at the Ten Commandments, because if there is a time that that it is important to make sure that we are securely grounded in what God says, I think that now is one of those times, because we see so much of it being called into question, and we see so much of it being challenged in a variety of ways. And so we went over the first commandment. If you wanted to turn there, we'll be in Exodus 20 for a bit. But in Exodus 20, verses 2 to 3, we see what God says. He says, He brought them out of Egypt. He saved them, preserved them. Kind of a therefore, you shall have no other gods before me. And so he gives the underpinnings of the relationship. He says, look, I have invested in you. And we know this, that before the foundation of the world, Jesus Christ died for the ungodly. So that was a part of the plan. In the same way here, God in his relationship with ancient Israel says, look, before I ever asked anything of you, I brought you out of Egypt. Therefore, you shall have no other gods before me. So we see that basis of the relationship and of that the expectation then that he places on the house of Israel, and by extension for us today as well, as children who are called out, who have an understanding of his plan, that we would also then, because he has saved us from the death penalty, because Jesus Christ is the vine and went before and died for us so that we would be able to know, be have the Father revealed to us, because of that, we ought to live in a certain fashion. So you guys are probably already there. I should have been turning there while I was talking. Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 through 6. Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 through 6. We're going to read the second commandment here. Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 through 6. It says, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above, or is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. And we take that and we say, no graven images, right? That's a pretty detailed and weighty command. And I want to unpack that a bit today and consider what all that means. Because very oftentimes when we're reciting, remembering, putting into our memory banks, what is the second commandment? You say, no gods before me, no graven images. And then you say, you know, you just go down the list, don't curse, keep the Sabbath, right? And we kind of truncate them. There's a lot in this verse, just like there is a lot in the honor your father and mother, right? But in this second commandment, I want to read this again so we can hear the entirety of it. It says, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. So God takes the time, he says, you look up, you look straight across, you look down. Whatever you see, don't make a god out of that. All right, whatever you can see, any likeness of anything. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And so we see that jealousy in our modern vernacular very often has a selfish, inward connotation. The word that they're using for jealousy here is much more of a zealous desire for. God has a zealous desire for us. Would you like to be loved by someone so much that they're going to do whatever it takes to preserve you, to take care of you? That's the jealousy that we're talking about here. Not like no one else is going to have you. And so, you know, we see this sometimes when they try to show this in movies or media of any sort. It's like someone's just selfishly jealous. I want it. All of these things. I'm jealous that you have this thing. God says, I'm jealous for you. So jealous. I'm so zealous and so in love with you as your father, that this is how I'm going to act, and so this is also how I expect you to act. Okay? So, for he is a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So we not only see here a bit about God's expectation for mankind not to make a carved image of anything that they see, we also see that he's very particular about it. Not only is he very particular about it, but he says, if you do it, long-reaching, far-reaching across time and generations, the ramifications and the consequences of going against this. This is a pretty big thing. Those are hefty words. If you're saying, for three generations, so my kid and my kid's kid, they might have ramifications from this if I don't do what is right. Well, that's not fair. They didn't do anything. God's very serious about this. He's extremely serious about this. So is this just a no graven images thing? How do we look at this? How do we look at this? I think that sometimes it can be easier for us, if we understand God's plan, to just look outwardly and say, well, other people who don't understand God's plan, we can say that, well, they don't understand. They're actually worshiping false gods, right? So people don't feel like they're not worshiping the one true God when they're going to church or anything like that. And maybe we'll shy away from saying that they're worshiping idols. But if we understand God's way, and it's either God's way or not God's way, that's really all that there are. It's as cut and dry as that. So if it's God's way or not God's way, then we can look and we can say, well, if you're worshiping another God, if you're worshiping in a different fashion, that is idolatry, right? That's, you're worshiping another God. You have worshipped, bowing down to, serving another God. You think about things, whenever I think about idols in this way, I think about Dagon, and I think about the hilarity of what happened to the Philistines when they capture the Ark of the Covenant, are like, ha, 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 we have their God now. And then you watch Dagon fall down across the threshold and his head is smashed, and you're like, oh, no, we don't want this. And then they're like, well, we don't want him here. So they send off the Ark of the Covenant, and every town that the Ark goes to, they have disease, and they're like, we're done with this, and they send it back to Israel. And then it stays on a threshing floor for quite a while until David moved it to Jerusalem. But anyway, so when I think about idols, things that are actually crafted, things that are made, things that people bow down to, sometimes I'm like, well, that was then, right? We don't have idols that we do that to here in Western society as much. There might be some places that have icons or deities. You can go kiss the toe of St. Peter if you really want to. There was a church on the, I think it's 71 that goes north and south out of Cincinnati. It's either 71 or 75. I can't remember right now. Might be 75. Anyway, going between Cincinnati and Dayton, there was a well-known statue on this church is off to the side of the road. You can Google it. It was called Big Butter Jesus. And it was called that because they had a guy almost like Christ the Redeemer down in Rio de Janeiro, but they had him coming out of water. It was supposed to be the resurrection, coming out baptismal water. But they had him, and he was up like this, and it looked like he was melting down into the water. So if you look up Big Butter Jesus, you'll see it. But people have different things that they're like, oh, that's how we identify. That's the thing that kind of like is the calling card of our church, of our congregation, or whatever it is. There are places here in town. I mean, there's a cross you can see coming from the eastern side of Morton that no matter what direction, you're always going to see that it's a cross because they set it up. It's a sculpture. And from the artistic aspect of things, you're like, oh, well, that's a pretty nifty working of the angles and the illusion so that you always see a cross no matter what direction. I mean, that took some math to do that and figure that out and set that up. That's kind of intriguing in that way. But other than some of those things that we would classify as icons, generally speaking, I'm not walking down the road going like, oh, there's a temple to Diana. Oh, there's Zeus. Oh, there's this. We don't have these things, I would say, as much bombarding our minds. At least we think we don't have those bombarding our minds as people at other times. Being that the most people here have been in Church of God for a long time, you've probably heard the phrase, well, anything can become an idol, right? Have you guys heard that? Anything can become an idol. And we'll say, well, if you put something before God, well, that can become an idol. So we're talking about idols. We're looking at what, and we want to be able to expand out verses 4, 5, and 6 here in Exodus 20. And I want to, for us sitting in this room, ask the question, what would it take for us, you or me, put your name there, not just us as a group, what would it take for us, one of God's children, to make an idol? Because I think it can be very easy for us to say, well, I'm not wearing a cross, I don't have a little Buddha on my desk, or I don't have, and you can go to any Chinese restaurant, you'll see any number of deities that are there. I don't have a little shrine on the dash of my car. You know, I don't have idols. But then we also kind of have that concept of, well, if you put anything in front of God, well, that can be an idol. And sometimes you can contrast that. Well, what about my filial piety, the responsibility I have as a husband or as a wife to the family? So, okay, so hold on, how do you balance that out? And I want to look at, as we're considering idols and what the depth of is being said here in the commandment, the second commandment, and asking the question of ourselves, what it would take for one of us to make an idol in our life. Let's go back to Exodus 32. Actually, it's forward from here. Exodus 32, if you want to keep your spot here in Exodus 20, you can. And we'll come back here one or two more times. But Exodus chapter 32, verse 1. What you have between Exodus 20 and Exodus 32 is a listing of various laws that God was giving to Moses. He was up there on the mountain for 40 days. He's getting these laws for governance, civil governance of the children of Israel. Some of them are regarding the tabernacle. Some of them are regarding the various other things that he's going to have Moses go down and oversee the creation of for the children as they're going through the wilderness in their wandering years. But in chapter 32, we get here in verses 1 through 7, an introduction to their first physical idol as a nation after they've come out of Egypt. Trying to choose my words there, just because I think, as we'll get into this a little bit more, we'll see that it. I will say that I don't think that this was their first idol; it's just the first one that they made. How's that? We'll get into that. So, verse 1 of chapter 32 says, "Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, 'Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, a man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.'" And Aaron said to them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in their ears, which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." Then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves." There are some really interesting things that are recorded in this passage as we look at the behavior, the actions of the children of Israel. One of the first things I'd like to point out is you go back to verse 1. The children of Israel say to Aaron, "Come," in the middle of that, they say, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt." See, when they were looking at and assessing what was going on in life, to whom did they attribute their success? If you go back to Exodus 20, was it something in the heavens, on earth, or below? Yes, it was one of those things, something that had been created. It was a man. It was a person. And then they said, well, so it was as a physical person. We don't know what has happened to him. And so, instead of having all the miracles, I mean, it was a song to Moses when they went through the Red Sea. They complained to Moses when they didn't have water. Everything was directed at him. It's much the same way that you think about Samuel and the story of him when the children of Israel said, make us a king. And God says, oh, it's not you that they're rejecting, Samuel. It's me that they're rejecting. Here at the beginning, the inception, you could say, of the nation of Israel as a people with an identity, when they were freed, they attributed that not to God, but to a physical individual, something that had been created. In this case, Moses, right? And on the heels of promising to God that no matter what, all that you say, we're going to do. You go back to Exodus 19, we kind of covered this when we did the lead up to the first commandment, right? They said, all you say, we will do. Because he had said, children of Israel, I brought you out of the land of Egypt, up out of the house of bondage. Before, you know, and today, I want you to know that I will be your God and you will be my special people if indeed you will obey my commandments and do all that I say. And they say, oh, all that you say we will do. Well, how quickly the tides have turned. I don't know what happened to that guy. You know, he's gone. What do we do now? It's been 40 days. And so they go and they make an idol. These are people who, again, I've mentioned it on a number of occasions, when they're coming out of Egypt, they knew in the moment, at least, they acknowledged in the moment, that as they were coming out, the God who was protecting them was stronger than the gods of the land they were in, right? So their dad was stronger, ha ha ha, we won. And then they go out and they're like, I don't know what happened to dad, I think he ditched. He went to the store to go get something and he's gone. Where did he go? Don't know. Let's find a new dad, right? And so that's how quickly they shifted. And so the children of Israel here are just bouncing back and forth between the gods who they had been familiar with beforehand and where they are now, looking at God and whether or not they actually attribute to him what it is that he had done. Let's go to Judges chapter 8. Let's go a little bit further down because it's a very interesting story to read here on the heels of just reading what Aaron and the children of Israel did. Judges chapter 8. We're going to read verses 22 to 28. Judges chapter 8, verses 22 to 28. Early on here, as the children of Israel are in the promised land, yet do not have a physical king. Do not have a physical king. And it's important to note the difference of physical king. Judges chapter 8. If you go back a few chapters, you actually see this is a story of Gideon, concept of the fleece, and God used him to save the children of Israel from the people of Midian. Miraculous fashion. It is actually to the point that the children of Israel said, you know what, you have saved us. Be our king. And he says, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to rule over you. God is the ruler. And so then, actually, verse 22, let's actually read it, because that's where I said the start. So the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Good answer, Gideon. Excellent. That's how it ought to be, all right? And he's pointing them back to God. It's not me, it's God. Don't put me into the place. Because this is exactly what everything else kind of functioned. If you go down through the story of Israel, you'll see when they separated from Judah, Judah retained the lineage of David on the throne. But that was weird compared to everybody around them, because it was whoever was strongest and biggest, had the biggest club, would take out the other guy, and then as long as he could keep his lineage strong, then his people would be on the throne until the next guy who had a bigger club sort of thing would come over and take them out. But he was like, oh, Gideon, you're a strong guy, you saved us, you be our king, we're all right with that. And then Gideon said to them, I would like to make a request of you, verse 24, that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So they answered, we will gladly give them. And they spread out a garment, and each man threw into it the earrings from his plunder. And the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes, which were on the kings of Midian. So if you look back, he killed two of the kings of Midian. There were crescents that had been around the camels and the other things. So this is besides that, things which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were around their camels' necks. Then Gideon made it into an ephod, and he set it up in this city, Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. Thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. So they had 40 years of peace, but what did they do? What did Gideon do? You know what? I remember there was this, remember that ephod that they had for the, who wore the ephod? Only one person wore the ephod, and that was the high priest. It was the ephod for the priest. He makes a golden ephod, which is something that God said, and he gave the directions to Moses for how to make it. This is a righteous thing. It's not a bad thing to have an ephod, right? It's from God. So he makes this golden ephod. It's a big one, made out of all of this gold. It's kind of like what Nebuchadnezzar did. He's like, oh, there's going to be a golden head, and then you go down to the bronze chest, and he's like, oh, you said a gold, and I'm the golden head. 90 foot tall. We're going to do this. Let's make this happen. This was a vision from God told to me and explained to me from one of, and I recognize that he is the God of everything. Thank you, Daniel. We're going to go make that 90-foot statue now, right? And he set it up, and it becomes quickly a form of worship for the people of Babylon, all right? Well, here, these are righteous. I mean, Gideon, used by God, a humble person who didn't want to sit there and put himself forward to be the king of the people, says, how about this ephod? I mean, it's rooted in truth. It's rooted in righteous observance and worship of God, right? We got a golden ephod. Let's use that. But it became a snare to Gideon and to his house, and the people played the harlot. What does that mean? It became an idol. A harlot. When God is talking about it, he's talking about it. Instead of being true to God and worshiping him, they shifted over, and the ephod was the thing. Just like with the children of Israel, they're coming out of land. Oh, we're watching the cloud move, the fire move, we're following it. Hold on, where'd it go? It's on that mountain up there. Pretty sure it killed Moses. Don't know what happened to him. Let's get a new God. Let's get a new thing to follow. Right? So they shifted and they moved over, turning back to their idols. If you go back into the history of Gideon, what's the first thing that God told him to do? He says, tear down the altar that's in town. Oh, that's his dad's altar. And all the people in town are angry. That's the first thing God asked him to do. What is the last thing that we get there in the story of Gideon? He essentially puts another one up. But it's more righteous because it's an ephod. And that was part of the worship that God had commanded. And so easy for us to traverse from one thing into the other thing. Even while you could say that this was a man of character, who wasn't going to put himself forward, and yet what he did was not something that God had wanted. Let's go a little bit farther down in the book of Judges to chapter 17. This is an interesting story. We're only going to read 13 verses. That's the whole chapter of 17. But if you want to continue reading, it's an intriguing story going into chapters 18. Actually, even into... Yeah, if you go read through 18, it gets... juicy. It's a drama going on. But Judges chapter 17, verse 1, it says, there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim, whose name was Micah. So Ephraim, you're right there, they are the largest tribe of the ten in the northern area. Actually, this is even before they have the separation. So it's one of the largest tribes. There was a man named Micah, and he said to his mother, you know those 1,100 shekels of silver? Which is right about the same. I didn't remember the number that Gideon got. He got something like 1,700 shekels. So he's got 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and on which you put a curse. Interesting exchange here. Even saying it in my ears. Here's the silver with. Even saying it in my ears. So he knew about the curse. It says, "Here's the silver with me." I took it. You know that silver that you lost, you thought was gone? You're like, oh, cursed to the person who took it. He's like, I took it. It was me. I stole it from you, Mom. Here it is. And his mother said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my son. It's kind of like, almost like, oh, you know, I'm happy it's back, sort of thing. But she says, may you be blessed by the Lord. So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you. She's like, I had dedicated it to the Lord on your behalf. I'm just going to give it to you. Now, it's also interesting here in this section. You know what it says when it talks about a carved image and a molded image? You know what the molded image is? It's the same word for the molded calf that is back in Exodus 32. Same word. So we can't say for sure that it was a calf, but it is the same word as describing a molded image. Again, go back to Exodus 20, and what does it say? Don't make any carved image of something in the heavens, on earth, or in the sea below. But she says, let's dedicate it. And they make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you. Thus he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and molded image. And they were in the house of Micah. So Micah's there. He's a thief. He's been hiding from his mom. Reveals it to his mother. And then she seems to be okay with it. And they make a molded image, a carved image. And he now has it in his house. Like, that's, how would you do this? As the people of Israel, you're in the promised land now. You have received, starting to receive the promise. I mean, obviously you've been blessed. You've got that much silver. That's a lot. It's a lot of wealth that's right there. And so he is having it in his house. You think, it makes me think about Rebecca. Rachel. Rachel, right? So she stole her father Laban's household idols. People had household idols. They're like, oh, this is my idol. But he goes and he has this set up in his house. The man Micah, verse 5, had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols. So it was righteous because he had an ephod, right? But goes back to, again, the same sort of thing that Gideon was dealing with. Again, goes back to the same sort of thing that the children of Israel were dealing with when they made the calf. All right. And second half of verse 5, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So this is interesting. Ephraim, right, recognizes one of the leading tribes. Interestingly enough, you'll see that so Ephraim rejected God. So God, he was going to have Ephraim as his people, but he's like, nope, you've rejected him. And so he turned him away. And you see that the leadership of the nation ends up being there in Judah. But he had offered it. Later on, actually, you'll see that he offered it to Saul, who was a Benjamite, right? Then he offered it to David, who was of the tribe of Judah. But you see, God was looking for somebody who was going to follow. Ephraim didn't follow. But this man, he's from Ephraim. However, even if he was from Ephraim, and even if Ephraim was being obedient to God, who were supposed to be the priests? The Levites, right? Not all Levites were priests, but all priests were Levites, only from the tribe of Levi. This is the whole issue with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, right? Because they were kind of vying and saying that they should be having a position. But he goes and he makes someone, his son, from the tribe of Ephraim, a priest. Sounds a lot like Jeroboam, doesn't it, right? Sounds a lot like people doing what is right in their own eyes. There was no king in Israel, and so people did what was right in their own eyes. Oh, wait, there, I should just read the next verse. Verse 6. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah. Of the family of Judah, he was a Levite and was staying there. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. This is an interesting thing as well. Because you remember how God parsed out the promised land for the children of Israel? He said, here's your space, here's your space. Now you guys all have land, everybody but the Levites have land. The Levites are going to get these various cities within your areas, right? And they're going to be to you there, the priests, they're going to be there as the Levites. They're going to assist you in following me. That's what their job was, to remind people of what God's law was in the various areas where they were. So this man stationed there, he was stationed in Bethlehem in Judah. And we're going to see what he does. He leaves that. He leaves that to stay wherever he could find a place. Is he listening to God? Is he staying where God told him? It's an interesting thing. If you get out a map, I didn't map this out, but it's an interesting thing when you look at the map, you look at where he was and where he was going. Very much falls into the same category of Balaam as a priest for hire. It's like he's willing to go. You'll see that in chapter 18 as well if you read on. But so he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah as he journeyed. Verse 9, and Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" So he said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am on my way to find a place to stay." Another interesting thing about this, it is believed that he was actually a great-grandson, or a grandson or a great-grandson of Moses. So he was there. He was, again, not a priest, but he was a Levite, right? And he says, "I'm on my way to find a place to stay." And Micah said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance." So the Levite went in. He's like, oh, this is a pretty good deal. You find out, again, if you carry on, he's a Levite for hire. He's happy to go where he's going to go. He didn't like where he was down in Bethlehem, Judah. Comes up, finds a guy who's going to pay him to be there. He's like, this sounds good. And Micah, we'll see his response here. So the Levite was content to dwell with the man, verse 11, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated a Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as a priest." Psh, sorry, son, not a Levite. You're gone. I've got this new Levite, actual Levite, right? He's going to be the priest. You ever have a situation in life where you're seeking God's will, seeking his input, and you say, you know what? I'm going to look for a sign that what I'm doing is right. Doesn't specifically say here, but I wonder whether or not Micah was doing that to kind of justify what he was doing. Because the tail end here in verse 13, he's like, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as a priest." I mean, he sends a Levite. What I'm doing here with the household idols and the ephod, the silver ephod, it can't be that bad. I mean, would a Levite, one of God's chosen people, come and be willing to be the priest in my house if this was wrong? Surely not, right? And you can go down and you can actually see the book of, you see Dan come in chapter 18. It's interesting because they also were unhappy with God, what God had given them. You gave them this spot down here and they're like, "Oh, it's too tough. The people are always fighting us. Let's go find another spot that we can go." And they end up going through the house of Micah. They take the Levite, the ephod, and they set up a shrine in Dan, which interestingly enough, when you have an ephod, you can go through scripture and you'll see that that ephod stayed there the entire time. And where did Jeroboam set up worship to stop people from going down to Jerusalem? Dan. And so this stuck with them for a long time. It stuck with them for a long time. But here what we see is we see people who should know better, people who knew about God, knew what his promises were, had seen it, whether it was people in the desert, people coming out in the wilderness, coming out of Egypt for that generation of people, the generation of people who came into the land, the promised land, as they crossed over the Jordan, to be able to see Jericho fall, to be able to see God open up the promised land to them, the ease with which they were able to take over the spaces and to have their inheritance, right? They saw that, but what they did is they tried to find a way to worship God partially with something that he had specified to them, but also we see them defining it in their own fashion. So those are some examples of people turning to idols, or you could probably argue turning back to idols, going back to, as a dog does to its own vomit. There's just things that they went back to that. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 10. As we're tying this, and actually, before we go to Jeremiah 10, let's go back to Exodus 20. And we'll see here, Exodus chapter 20. We see here the first part of this command, verse 4, says, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything." And these people justified for themselves that it was okay to do. And I don't think it's an accident they chose the ephod. The ephod was a symbolism of the high priest. And so if you have the high priest there or something that the high priest would wear, I don't think that was an accident. That's what they chose to have as an image that they set up, or as an idol that they set up. But it says nothing that is in heaven above, or that's on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Don't bow down to that. And this is exactly what they did. And we're going to get into the second portion here, where it says, this is in verse 5, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. Why is idolatry such an egregious act in the eyes of God? Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 10 now. Jeremiah 10, we'll read the first five verses, Jeremiah chapter 10. This is a area of scripture that really brings out the futility, I'll say, of idols. It says, Jeremiah chapter 10, verses 1 through 5, it says, hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Here they are as a nation that is on the I think actually by this time the nation of Israel had already been taken into captivity, if I remember correctly, because Jeremiah was preaching to Judah. But it says, thus says the Lord, do not learn the ways of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the Gentiles are dismayed at them. It's like, they don't understand. They see these things, they don't get it. When you see these things, you should not be responding in the same way they do, because you know. For the customs of the peoples are futile. For one cuts a tree from the forest, the works of the handle of the workmen, work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. They are upright like a palm tree, and they cannot speak. They must be carried because they cannot go by themselves. Now, some people will use this to talk about Christmas trees. I'm just going to talk about how silly it is to think that when you make something yourself, that it suddenly becomes what you should bow down to. And yet this is exactly what Jeremiah is bringing out. He's like, if you cut it down and you made it and you have to carry it around, what is it doing for you? What could it possibly do for you? That's where it's like, that's again where I think of Dagon, and I think of Dagon like falling and his head breaking off and he's shattered there at the threshold of the temple. It's hilarious to think, to me, caveat, having the understanding that I have with God's spirit, it becomes one of those things where, like, humanly speaking, you're like, okay, let's follow the lines of logic here. You found the tree. You cut the tree. You carved the tree. You covered the tree with gold and engraved upon it. And then you bow down to the tree, the thing that was made from the tree, like it has power and influence over you. But the truth of the matter is that actually, if you go back, you'll see, just with the golden calf, with the ephods, none of those things have any more power or sway over you than you give them. You can talk to any number of individuals, ministers who have served in various other areas that are more superstitious or more Mr. Kisa, the word I'm thinking of, when you're going into Africa where you have more witchcraft, or you have the superstition of things and the mysticism of stuff, and you will find that individuals who believe in it end up seeing it, end up experiencing it in a fashion that you or I might not, because we don't give power to that. I mean, it says do not give place to the devil. Well, you know, if you give him a spot at the table, you might have some conversations with him. If you don't invite him in, well, he's outside, and you draw near to God, and he's going to draw near to you. You can go read James and read that. But let's go to Romans chapter 1. So Jeremiah brings out the concept of the futility of idolatry. Paul brings this out in Romans as well. As I was putting this together, I was like, I've been coming to Romans 1 a lot, but I think that it just brings out the inanity of this all. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 through 23 is what we'll read. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness." If we're honest with ourselves and we're talking about idolatry, we're talking about these various things in our lives that have power and have sway over us, it falls into this category, you know, suppressing the truth. He's like, you can't honestly say that you believe that that thing that you made has real influence or power over you. You have to do some mental gymnastics to get there. Verse 19, "But because what may be known of God is manifest to them." This is why you can recognize that it's being suppressed. "For God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful." That right there, I think you can overlay so far over every example we've looked at in the scripture. Though they knew God, they did not glorify him as God. That was Moses who brought us out of the land of Egypt. That was Gideon who saved us. You know what? That ephod that the high priest wears, that's really what sets us apart. We need to make sure we have that. They were not thankful. "Where's my water? Where's my food? Why is it so hard to inherit this land, God? Why are you making it difficult on us? How come I am not able to become wealthy like Micah? You know, I'll tell you what, sure happy God that you guided me to this house where I can actually have a living wage and do well here with the clothing. He's covering my room and board. I mean, this is what a blessing, you know, how we attribute things. But this is what the people are doing. They're not glorifying God. They're not thankful. And so they become futile in their thoughts and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, verse 22, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. When we do not acknowledge the first commandment, when we don't acknowledge God and what he has done, we're not thankful. We attribute it to other places. You know, time and chance happens to all. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. You know, I knew the right people. They really got me a foot in the door, a leg up, whatever it is. Paul is pointing out here what happens when people pursue idols and not God. Let's go to Isaiah 64 as we begin to kind of pull this all together. Isaiah chapter 64. We'll start in verse 8. Isaiah 64, verse 8. Hopefully this answers the question, why does God see idolatry as such an egregious act? Because here in Isaiah 64, verse 8, it says, "But now, O Lord, you are our Father. We are the clay, and you are the potter. And all we are the work of your hand." If you're not drawing the link here, maybe I can help a little bit. This is talking about the hierarchy of how things are. Romans 1 talks about us refusing to accept the hierarchy of how things are. And when we do that, we're futile in what we're doing. We go and we'll build, as Jeremiah said, these wooden things. We'll set up these physical things. We'll put these things in place that ought not be there. Because we have flipped upside down what is found here in Isaiah 64, verse 8. God is the potter. We are the clay. We are the works of his hand. It's not the other way around. What is idolatry? Idolatry, and it's such an egregious act because idolatry is ignoring the first commandment and saying, you're not God. I am the God. I will now be the potter, and I will form with my own hands the thing that is divine because I can do that, or you can do that. Now, when we think about idolatry from that perspective, not just the physical thing that somebody can make and carve, but it's the act of us putting ourselves into the position of the potter. It's us putting ourselves into the position of the creator and the divine to bestow upon something else a nature that we ourselves have no right doing because we are not divine and we cannot do that. And you can now see this, if you're thinking about it from this perspective, you can see this happening in many cases where there is no physical thing ever made. There's nothing that was actually created in front of them, and yet you'll see the same behavior because it feeds right into, I am the God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. Well, question. What about me? What if I'm there in front of you? Because I'm pretty sure that, you know, I've got a pretty good perspective on things. And so people place themselves. Micah placed himself into that position. Gideon placed himself into that position. Aaron placed himself into that position. We can very easily also place ourselves into the position where we are defining, trying to be the one who's molding the clay to create whatever it is that we want to manifest as God. To partake in idolatry is really to wantonly ignore the rationale behind that first commandment. Because God has done all of that. And the reason that the second commandment is not just about graven images, the reason that he looks at it and says, this is such an egregious thing that I'm going to visit it upon the third and the fourth generation to those who hate me. Because you're saying, I'm God. Let's go to Isaiah 14. We're here in Isaiah. Let's turn closer to the front of the book. Isaiah 14, verses 12 to 14. This mindset of wanting to be the one who defines what is divine, who is in charge of our lives, is found right here. Isaiah chapter 14, verses 12 through 14, says, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. You who have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the earth. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. I will be the potter. I will be the one who says what worship should happen. That's the exact lie that he told, if you want to reference Genesis 3. It's the exact thing that he offered to Adam and Eve. It's the exact thing that he offered to Jesus Christ when he was tempting him. I'm going to give you this position. Let me define to you what it is that you should bow down to. And to Adam and Eve, he said, oh, don't you want these things? Isn't this good? There was no idol created in Genesis 3, created, formed by the hand, but there was one created in the minds of Adam and Eve as they looked and she saw that the fruit was good and desirable to make one wise. And so she made an idol in her mind, and she placed herself into the position of defining what was good and what was right. And therein broke the covenant with God that he would be the one who provided food, he would be the one who provided truth, he would be the one who provided protection. That's the exact same thing that happened in Israel when Moses is gone. They're in the wilderness. Moses is gone. Oh no, who's going to protect us? Because what were they scared of? They were scared of Pharaoh. You see that, oh, you brought us out here to die. We're going to die here. Moses says, shh, just stand and see the deliverance of the Lord. Right? But they were too busy looking to that physical thing that God clearly said, don't look there. And they set it up. We can do this so easily where we will interchange something physical for the actual spiritual action or the miracle that God is doing in our lives, and we just swap them. And then, when push comes to shove in a difficult situation, we'll follow the physical thing, be it a man, a pastor in a congregation, be it a golden calf, right? Well, the man's gone, so what are we gonna do now? Gotta have another physical thing, make an idol. When we worship idols, we are essentially putting ourselves in the place of the creator. Again, this is the nature of man, and this is what we have to fight. This is this is the essence of who we are, and knowing that this is our struggle, it makes perfect sense why this is the second commandment. God sets out the definition of the relationship. He says, I love you, I provide for you, I care for you. Don't put anything else before me. Don't make a graven image. You're going to think that you're going to be doing something good, but it's not. I'm so jealous, I'm so zealously desirous of having a relationship with you. And I know that if you do this, it's going to carry on. And you can see, I mean, we looked at it there in Exodus 32. We looked at it in Judges 8. We looked at it in Judges 17. And you can go right down through. Guess what? The propensity of people to continue to follow those things is there. It's rooted in us. It's rooted in us. And we have to pull that out. Prune it off, as we heard in the first message. Ask God to prune that off, because otherwise, we're going to be in the same situation here as Lucifer. We're going to be in the same situation as anyone else who's had the gall to put ourselves into the place of the Creator and say, well, we can set what is divine and what is not. Let's go back to Exodus 20. One last time here, Exodus chapter 20. We'll read it again, verses 4 through 6. It says, you shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. These are all physical things. And so sometimes we can sit there and say, well, if there's not a physical thing, it's not actually an idol. But hopefully, as we've been talking today, it's become clear, if it wasn't before, or it's been just reiterated, that it doesn't have to be a physical thing, because what the idol, the physical idol is really just the final step of the manifestation of us turning our back on our Father. That's what the cow was for the children of Israel. You can go back, read how they're leaving Egypt. They kept questioning his faith in them, his ability to protect them. And so when he was gone long enough, when Moses was gone long enough, they said, well, nope, we're going to go and follow something else. Right? It was just the manifestation of their mistrust all along the way. Because in order to be able to fully follow God and not have another God before him, and to not make something else that we think we need to follow, the requirement is to have faith in him. And so that physical thing that we read about here in verse 4 of chapter 20 in Exodus is just, it's just the last step. Maybe we don't have something set up, but I'm sure there are things in our minds, our hearts, and our priorities that we need to root out, that we allow to be there, because it can manifest itself in a way that is going to separate us from God. It says, you shall not bow down, verse 5, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. This is where we have the blessing of his love and continued understanding. You know, we can have these conversations because we understand, because we know, because, you know, I thank God that he has not manifested his truth to the wise, but to the babes, to the foolish, to us. That we get to see this, we get to understand this, we get to understand the relationship that he wants with us. And he's so zealous to have a relationship with us, to love us. Let's go in closing to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. We'll read verses 13 through 16. Because this, in essence, becomes the choice that is placed before us when we're thinking about God, when we're thinking about what is first in our life. It's not just the physical images that can be there. It can be all sorts of things. As long as we're willing to place it before God and to put ourselves into the position of being the one who has the authority to make that call, say, oh, well, this is important. I'm going to put it right there. No, God defines for us what's important. We have to accept that. Or not. You know, that's our choice. But here we see in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 through 16 is where we'll read. We see individuals who came before us. It says, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embrace them, and confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Now, it's an interesting thing that the children of Israel, if you look at, if you want to reference Acts 7, verses 38 through 41, Stephen said, you know, they went through, they left Egypt, but their hearts never left Egypt. The individuals we see here in Hebrews 11, 13 through 16, they had a choice in how they looked at things. They had a choice. They said, well, I could have considered where I'm going to go back. Do I want to go back to where I was? Or am I going to keep trusting that God is going to protect me, provide for me, and that this city, this country, the heavenly country, is really what I'm pursuing? Unlike the children of Israel, unlike the individuals who were following Gideon, unlike the individuals who were following Micah, unlike us in our weakened state, right? These individuals chose to look to God as the provider, as the father, as the protector, as the one, the sole source of truth. Anytime we don't do that, we are in the same boat as Lucifer, setting ourselves up to be the creator, the potter, who defines what is right and wrong, and defines what is divine, and defines what should be worshipped. And when we put ourselves into that position, we're making idols. Let's make sure we're not doing that, but instead glorifying our Father and following Him.